Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm looking at it going, if I keep pushing this hard and my kids are being educated at public schools or whatever it may be, it's like, okay, they're going to be gone out of the house. And are they going to have our values? Or are they going to have someone else's values? And
let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We've got a special guest today, Dale Stark, former A-10 pilot. So thanks for that. That's come in handy in my past.
Yeah, man, it was definitely a good ride. It was a lot of fun.
So let's go back to, before we get into all these specifics and such, let's go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up?
I grew up really a lot of different places. We had moved around quite a bit. I'd moved like 18 times by the time I was 18 years old. But for the most part, I consider like Southern Oregon home. That's where we were most of the time. It's where I was born, where I graduated high school, and where I moved back after the Air Force. So like I said, moved around a lot around the Pacific Northwest, West Coast, but for the most part, Southern Oregon is home.
Is that where you're there now?
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me about growing up there. I mean, I lived there for 1 year when I was like two or three, because my dad in Springfield, my dad was a logger for a while. He just got like after the army, he kind of got a wild hair up his ass and decided to go do some stupid shit and for a year, and then came back to reality. But I don't remember any of it. But what was it like growing up there?
It was just like being outside nonstop, you know. My dad did a whole bunch of jobs back in the day. He was like, you know, a rancher, a horseshoer. He was a logger, truck driver, you know, all kinds of stuff. But, you know, we always lived kind of outside of town on property adjacent to like public lands or logging lands. And I was just basically a free range kid. I was like very into kind of Gen X, early millennial time frame. And they just kind of cut you loose with your brothers and cousins and let you run wild as long as you came home kind of shortly after dark. So looking back, you know, it was really just kind of a privileged lifestyle. Not, you know, not that we had a ton of money or anything, but just had total freedom.
And how does that differ, you think, from the way kids are being raised today? Because that doesn't sound very familiar to most people out there probably at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole new can of worms there. But you look at kind of what social media, smartphone access for everyone, for kids and stuff. There's so many factors going into this. But, you know, you see kids today that have kind of introverted inside and their whole lives are on their phones. And their parents are kind of like overprotective on what's outside of the home, and then underprotected on, some real dangers, which is the online stuff. So, yeah, it just seems like it's really flipped a lot, and it hasn't been for the better for kids, as you can see with like the obvious results.
Sure, yeah. So you end up, what was the pathway to the military like for you? Like, when did you make the decision to do it, and then why did you choose to be a pilot, or what were the circumstances of that, I guess?
Yeah, so I was trying to like make things work in my hometown, so out here in Coos Bay, Oregon. And, you know, my parents are kind of old school, so it was like, hey, you turn 18, it's time to get a job, start paying rent. Mm-hmm. figure it out. So we were a little bit combative there. I wanted to continue wrestling. I was really into the sport of wrestling. I picked up a small scholarship at a local JUCO. And so I was just trying to go to school, wrestle, work part-time, work at home, kind of pay off my rent. And when I got behind, my parents, they said, hey, gave me a couple warnings, and then I was out. So it was like, kind of like you hear about. It was like show up one day and all my shit is just out on the front porch. So now I'm like 19, going to school, kind of couch surfing at friends' houses. I had considered the military like right out of high school, but decided I wasn't gonna go straight in. So, about a year and a half later, I'm like sleeping in my car a lot at the beach, and hungry all the time, tired, just nothing going for me. Really, just rock bottom. I like wasn't wrestling that great because my life was just complete chaos. And then I literally just hit rock bottom. I was one of those stories of just like I had nothing else going for me. I mean, I was basically failing out of community college, and so I went down, talked to all the recruiters, talked to Marines, Army, Air Force, and kind of going back and forth. This is pre-9/11, so I enlisted in '99, but I almost joined the Marines, and then kind of the last minute, I thought, well, if I go into the Air Force, I can get like a practical skill, something that I could, when I get out, I could use a GI Bill, get a professional job, a technical skill, something like that. So last minute, I decided to enlist in the Air Force as a mechanic. So went in, game plan was just do 4 year enlistment, see the world a little bit, and then get on with my life. So that's really how I ended up in the Air Force.
So you're a mechanic, you're enlisted now. That there's a lot of stuff that happens between then and becoming an A-10 pilot. So first, I guess, so your enlisted time was primarily pre-GWAT then.
Yeah, all of it. So
Okay.
I was only enlisted. I ended up only being enlisted for a year and a half. So one of those sayings like luck and timing is everything. Pretty quickly after I started down that path, I started recognizing, that it might actually be possible to become a fighter pilot. That was like, my first dream was to like fly the A-10. That was one of the first things that occurred to me when I was in maintenance school, that I could possibly do that would be awesome, So even though I had like terrible grades and no one would have ever pegged me to like be an officer or a pilot for that matter. For some reason I always had this like ridiculous unwarranted self-confidence. Like I felt like, well, I had all these external factors that led to my poor academic performance, and if I had a if I wasn't worried about the next meal I was going to eat, I'd probably do pretty good. So anyhow, so I kind of got that goal, that vision, and just started chipping away at it. So start knocking out like these challenge exams, start taking classes. Now I'm a little bit older, a little more mature, I've got a goal, and I start getting like excellent grades. And I learned like the game of school. It was like, okay, well, it's not that you have to be a genius to get straight A's. You just have to like understand what the professor is kind of expecting you to say, do all the homework, do all the study for all the exams, and it's actually not going to be very hard. So anyhow, so start being the best mechanic I could be, and going back to school, and telling people in my leadership that that's something I was interested in doing. And then a lot of us have experiences like as soon as you join the Air Force, join the military, it's like you start with that blank slate. You just no one cares about your background, where you came from. I had to get like a I think they call it a moral character waiver, because I had a minor possession of alcohol arrest when I was a kid. So it was like, but all that stuff before you joined was in the past, and now you have a fresh start. So, it really worked out. I just, again, started looking at what it took to become a pilot, started preparing myself in all the different areas. And, you know, as you know, the military is very task oriented. It's very straightforward. It's like, okay, if you want to be a pilot, you have to get a degree. You have to take this standardized test. You need a commander's recommendation. You need a certain score on this physical fitness test. So it's all right there. And if you want to put in the work and do it, then the opportunities were there, at least in kind of my time frame. So pretty much as soon as I hit the flight line, I just took off in that direction as well.
What was the process like, though? So you're an airman, maybe, probably, E3, and you decide you want to do this new trajectory. You start chipping away at pieces of it, but there's an administrative part as well. Like, how does that work with the Air Force? Who did you tell you wanted to be involved? Is there a recruiter that does that kind of stuff?
So I just essentially told my direct supervisor, and then it just got up through my chain of command. And the process is really just, it's like this one package, so to speak. So just, you have to start compiling all these different things. And I think they make the process as onerous and bureaucratic as possible. And it's like the first weeding out process, because so many people just get fed up and give up before they even, get off the ground there. So it's just like this massive amount of paperwork. So, all your transcripts, letters of recommendation, your test scores, your physical fitness scores. So you're just compiling all this stuff. You're hoping you can get a recommendation. And So, it takes a few months to get all this stuff together. And then I think at that time, too, it was pre-9/11, ops tempo was not ultra high. So it was if you wanted to do something like that and you showed that you had the aptitude, then your leadership would probably help you out. And that was the case for me. They're just hey, if you want to do it, go for it.
And so how does it work with the Air Force as far as, because we have, what does the Army call it? Green to gold or some bullshit like that, where you're an enlisted person, you can start the trajectory to become an officer, and you have a couple of years to get your degree and all that bullshit as you're going through the process. Then you go to officer OCS or whatever the fuck, or I think it's how it goes. But how does it work for the Air Force, I guess, to go from enlisted to officer? And then how is there is it different? Because you guys have the career path thing, and the Air Force is more complicated than the Army. I think the Army is pretty simple for most people. But for you guys, there's often a series of schools depending on what you're going to become. If you're an AFSOC or something, you go to the general AFSOC, you go to basic, then you go to the generalized AFSOC school, and then you go through the pipeline of wherever you're going to end up at. Is it the same for pilot, or what is it like for that?
Are you talking for once you get accepted into pilot training?
Yeah. So what, day one you're accepted, what's the process after that before you're in the cockpit?
Okay. Yeah. So you put in all your paperwork, you get accepted to go to ROTC for me. So there's a whole myriad of commissioning programs, like you talked about, similar to green to gold, whatever it may be. I got a 2-year ROTC scholarship. So for me, it was go knock out your 4-year degree. Now you're a commissioned second lieutenant. And then while you're in ROTC, you put in for your desired jobs. And then that's where you compete to attend pilot training. So so I was lucky enough to get a pilot slot. So right after commissioning, I go off to pilot training. And then pilot training is broken into multiple phases. And so after phase one, which is ground school, you go fly. Now it's a T-6. Back in my day, it was the T-37 or the T-34 with the Navy. And you finish that program, which is about 6 months, and then you're track selected. So this changes year to year again. So this is mainly for my era, but there's 30, 35 people, maybe like five or six will get selected for that fighter bomber track. So that's how you're going to end up in like F-15, F-16, A-10, B-1, or B-52.
And then otherwise you get sent to fly a school bus, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So then the rest of the guys go to what ends up either pipelining you into a heavy or a helicopter.
Okay. Where is it? Where's the Air Force Flight School?
There's a few. There's like four different, they call it UPT, undergraduate pilot training bases. But I went through T-38s at Vance Air Force Base in Enid, Oklahoma. But, you know, they're like Texas, Oklahoma, Mississippi. And that's all I can think of off the top of my head. Yeah, but there's a couple.
Okay. And then if you go to, if you end up being selected for rotary wing, I think that's all at Fort Rucker in Alabama, no matter what your branch of service is, right? I think.
Yeah, exactly. So after that phase two, the guys track selected for helos. Yeah, Fort Rucker with the Army.
And what was, how did you decide on A-10 specifically?
So I, like from day one, I was just enamored with the hog. So my first maintenance instructor, so when I'm going through the enlisted maintenance pipeline, my first instructor is a A-10 crew chief. So he was also like a Gulf War veteran, and just like the stories he had about the hog, and then, you know, so he's telling us all these war stories about the A-10 and the Gulf War, and just, you know, crushing Iraqi tanks and scud hunting. And I'm just, you know, as a young guy, my early 20s at that time frame, I was just fascinated with it. And the way he kind of framed it up was like, okay, you know, the brass, big Air Force really doesn't like this airplane or its pilots, but it's sticks around because it's highly combat effective, and just kind of, you know, that like rebellious kind of outcast community. So just something about it appealed to me. So that's kind of where I got the very first idea that, hey, like, how cool would that be to actually fly this thing? And the A-10 is so easy to maintain that they actually bring it in as an aircraft that you work on while you're going through fundamentals training. So, you know, you can like learn about a hydraulic system in the classroom, and then in the hog, you can just like open up panels and you can see like it's all laid out logically for you. So it's like, it's a perfect airplane for training. You're just like, oh, there's the hydraulic reservoir. There's the pump. Here's all the lines. Here's the valves and whatnot. So, you know, I'm this young guy, and I'm going through maintenance school, and it's at Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas, which is also a pilot training base. So when I'm in school during the day, I'm like, you know, I'm sitting in the cockpit, looking through the heads up display and looking at all the instruments, looking at the, you know, the wings, the gun, and just going like, I can't believe like people actually get paid to fly this. What an amazing job that would be. So, you know, from day one, I just wanted to fly the A-10, and that's really all I wanted to do at that point.
As far as non-transport military aircraft go, is it the longest in service? Like, I know Chinook is older, C-5 is older, C-130 is older, 47 is older, obviously. But it's, I think for ones that carry ordnance, it's got to be one of the oldest, because they started, these things came into service, what, in 77 or something like that?
Yeah, if you're if you don't count the B-52, which has been around for forever now, it's one of the older airframes now. I mean, you know, a lot of those fourth gen fighters came around similar time frame. So if you're looking at like, you know, A-10, F-16, F-15C, they're all kind of that post Vietnam era. But yeah, it's definitely a little long in the tooth now.
What is it about the A-10 that makes it so effective?
So it really comes down to the fact that they built a purpose-built aircraft for like close support. So you have, you know, if you look at like the history of the A-10 and how they, you know, built this amazing machine was, they got all of the CAS experts from Vietnam. So they took like the Sandy pilots, the OV-10 pilots, some of the OV-1, OV-2 pilots. They even went back to like World War II. They like looked at the Stuka pilots that, you know, or like fighting on the Eastern Front. They looked at the Thunderbolt pilots. They looked at like, they just took all these decades of war fighting knowledge and how we've like developed all of these kind of mission requirements for combined arms and then going into that CAS mission. And they brought them all in the room and we're just like started with the end goal of creating the perfect plane for close air support, forward air control, and combat search and rescue. So it was just purpose built for that mission. So, you know, they're like, okay, to be a good CAS plane, you need to be slower than like a fast mover. You need to be maneuverable. It needs to be survivable. So, you know, designing in things to the jet, like the pilot sits in a titanium bathtub that can absorb, you know, pretty large AAA, and it's not going to impact you as the pilot. Did things like self-sealing fuel tanks. So if you take a round through a fuel tank, it'll deploy foam and seal it up. So you don't just, you know, end up as a fireball. All the hydraulic lines say like the reservoirs are separate and all the lines run in separate locations. So if you take one round in the fuselage and you lose one hydraulic system, you might not necessarily lose the other. So, you know, and then they looked at, okay, usually in Vietnam per se, you'd have like an OB-10 pilot, or if it was a higher threat, maybe like an F-100 fastback. You know, they go out, find, fix, track a target, and then they bring in, say, like a four-ship of F-4s or F-105s, get them up to speed, on target, eyes on friendlies, mark the target, and then they strike the target and kill it with bombs or whatever it may be. So with the A-10, have almost 1,200 rounds of 30mm. You've got 11 hard points where you can carry pretty much any conventional weapon in the inventory. And then you can fly, you know, as a two or four ship. So you have a tremendous amount of firepower just embedded within your weapon system. So you can finish that target, you know, internally and not necessarily need to bring in another set of fighters to do that finish piece. So, yeah, it was just purpose built for that one mission. And that's really what made it such an effective airplane.
This episode is brought to you by Ghostbed. Ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. Go there today and get 50% off site-wide. All their mattresses, all the sheets, everything. They've got the Ghostbed Classic. They've got the Ghostbed 3D Matrix. They've got the Ghostbed Lux. And now they've got the new one, the Ghostbed Flex Hybrid. All these are cooling mattresses. They're the best in the business. They also have the new technology that we've been looking for all this time. Well, not we, just Joel, which is the RV mattress. Now, if you've got one of these things, you know that you can't find a mattress that fits them appropriately, at least not a good one. And the ones that come with them are terrible. So if you're an RV person, you definitely want to jump on that. And by the way, they got the best pillows in the business. You've heard me say it before, but I travel with these things. That's how good they are. It's kind of a pain in the ass, but not as bad as sleeping on hotel pillows, I'll tell you that much. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros today. Use the code Ghost or Drinker Bros at checkout. You're going to get 50% off all the mattresses. Check them out today. We've been with them for a while. I've got them all over my house. You know they're good. So my best advice here is go for the 3D Matrix. It's the most comfortable bed I've ever slept on in my life. Go get it today. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. Use the code Drinker Bros. You're going to get 50% off. That's 50% off. You're not going to get a better deal.
And there's not been a replacement for it. Right, we're 50 years into this platform, and it's still the most effective close air support providing instrument we have. I mean, I would say even more than the Apache, just because, you know, helicopters sitting still is typically not a good idea. There's been some movies made about that, I think, based on real life events. But yeah, people know the A-10. Anybody that's ever been in the military, anybody that's ever been in a gunfight, probably knows the A-10 just because
It has one of the most iconic sounds of all time. I think everybody can do an impression of it, and they're probably doing one in their head right now. It's like right on par with the sound of an AK or the rotor wash of a Chinook, like the chopping sound from a Chinook. Like, there's a couple of sounds that you hear and you just know what it is. And the sound of the main gun on the A-10 is one that has, you know, brought me some relief from time to time in my life, for sure, being an infantry guy. It's a lot of people in the Air Force and in the AFSOC community, especially, that's their favorite aircraft of all time. If you did a poll, I think that one would probably rate higher than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And to get at the heart of your question, there, the on paper, the replacement for the A-10 is the F-35, which is really not a replacement for the A-10. So, you know, there's like kind of the corporate argument that the A-10 is not survivable in the modern battle space. So they look at it. And again, a lot of this comes down to politics and, you know, budgets and where you want that money to go. But they technically, on paper, the replacement for the A-10 is the F-35. But as you and I both know, the F-35 is not purpose-built for close air support. And they're never going to, you know, you're never going to fly a $100 million fifth-gen fighter 100 feet above the ground, you know, in the mountains of Afghanistan or wherever the heck we end up next. It's just not going to happen. So they're more relying upon like precision munitions from altitude that can be fired at range. And kind of that's just the Air Force is getting away from that single mission mindset and going kind of back to the multi-role mindset. So we could talk about, you know, the reasons for that, the wisdom of that, but that's really just the decision that was made that, hey, we're not going to be as good at CAS, and but they think they don't necessarily need to because of the advanced technology.
When you say advanced technology, do you mean drones?
Well, yeah, I mean a combination of manned and unmanned assets, but really like the smart weapons and stuff. So the way that they would, I would say, picture it in the future is like the JTAC or, you know, the ground force commander, whoever it may be, designates the target, pulls the coordinates, and then just zaps them up to some either, you know, fifth gen asset or an unmanned asset. And then you basically program the bomb. They get within bomb range and hit that target, which it all, you know, works well and good in theory, but as you and I both know, that on the battlefield it's chaotic. It's constantly moving, everyone's trying to kill each other, and if you have a pilot that actually is more like a grunt in the sky, it's going to be a lot more effective because you're battle tracking with the ground forces, and they're providing that support real time. You're not just kind of a you know, observing this at a far distance and then putting a smart weapon on coordinates. Anyhow, long way to say is that it's really just a philosophical difference in what you believe the best way to attack this problem.
Well, sort of though, right? But there's like there's also a measure of practicality to it, like how do things actually unfold on the ground, which is the way they built the A-10 in the first place. Like in close air support, especially in an urban environment, right, where you can't just blow the fucking shit out of everything, the best use of fifth gen fighters I've seen in CAS is like a show of force in an open field somewhere, or buzzing super low, like 40, 50 feet above ground, is to get that sonic pop and scare the locals and shit like that. But as far as putting, as they like to call it, warheads on foreheads, or just rounds on target in general in an actual close air support situation, in an urban environment, I don't see how you use a fifth gen fighter like that without creating unsustainable downstream damage that we're just not prepared to fucking handle, right?
Yeah, and it's like it comes down to the wars that they predict and are preparing for that they think they might fight someday. So it's like, okay, we're going to go for these, we're going to build an Air Force 100% for these near peer, you know, competitor nations, if you will. So, you know, obviously you're looking at like Russia, China, things like that. So, so those are the wars they want to prepare for. But what, where are we actually going to end up fighting? You know, we keep talking about pivoting to the Pacific out of the Middle East, and then can't seem to get away from there. So, yeah, I mean, you look at the wars we're actually going to fight, and then what's the actual rules of engagement going to be? And yeah, having a precision, you know, 30 millimeter that can strike a target in close proximity to friendlies in an urban area with minimal collateral damage, like that actually fits the bill for things we actually do.
Yeah, exactly.
Just things, I mean, we theorize about.
As somebody who's been in a couple of gunfights in urban areas and even in open urban areas to some degree, there's just there we don't have a replacement for it. Apaches are really nice if they're coming in from somewhere else to do a quick hit and fuck off. Even little birds with many guns are good for that as well. But having them linger in the airspace, there's quite a bit of difference between 3,000 to 5,000 feet in elevation and 16,000 feet in elevation where you're out of the range of RPGs, right? I mean, just from a practicality standpoint, you know, and we know all too well now how that works. When one of your birds gets rocked, that your whole mission's fucked for one. And two, you put probably 3 times the amount of people in danger that needed to be now, because you're going to have to bring in additional, like you're going to have to cordon off that area, get those people out, destroy that piece of equipment, whatever. There's all, it's a fucking shit show, right? And combat operations are about the objective, sure, but a lot of it is risk mitigation as well, right? Like, we don't want to take unnecessary risk. We want to take measured, calculated risk that makes sense and not expose ourselves. That's why in the infantry we have, like, we attack when we have 3-to-1 odds, right? That's kind of our standard for doing a kinetic operation typically. It doesn't, man, it's so weird that the A-10 might be the last piece of military hardware that was actually designed by people who know how to fucking use it, right? Like, I see, maybe you could make the case for these new SIG battle rifles and shit like that. I don't really know. I didn't have any insight into how that selection process happened. But as far as the engineering part, building something for a specific task and having the people who actually know about it being involved in that process, I think the A-10 might be the last one. And it was 1972 when it took its first flight. That's how long ago that was.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right when it comes to like the capability of the Hog versus some of the attack helos. I mean, they all have their place, of course. But there's a big difference between the speed and range. You know, if you're in a gunfight in the mountains of Afghanistan, you might not be able to get an Apache over there. There's a lot of different factors. So it really increases the capabilities of the ground force commander, in my view. And yeah, you're absolutely right. And it really shows just kind of the degradation of the entire like procurement process and the defense industry. And you look at like all the problems going on with Boeing and how, you know, if you dig into a lot of their current problems, a lot of experts will say that they went from focusing on the engineering and like hyper empowering these like wicked smart engineers. So old Boeing would take like the smartest engineer as a team lead and give him like godlike powers over his project. And they came up with some of the best airplanes that, that ever flew, you know? And then over time, they, you know, all these like MBAs and managers took over, they merged with McDonnell Douglas. They start importing a ton of the parts that go into Boeing aircraft. They outsource a bunch of the, like code writing and a lot of the technical stuff. And so all of a sudden it's all, you know, it's this globalized system. They've moved from that like area of expertise up by Tacoma, Washington. They built plant in South Carolina. And all of a sudden it's like, nobody's feels like they're actually in charge. And then you look at the products they're putting out now and they're nothing like what they put out in the past as far as like that expert engineering, not redundancy, and just everything they built into that kind of first generation of the 7 series aircraft. And you see that, I think, across the entire like, you know, military industrial complex, to where Now it's all about the dollars and cents. It's about, you know, when they developed the F-35, they openly brag about how it's like procured in 48 states. They have, you know, contractors all over the country and money going over all over the country. And really that has become the priority over like that end product, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that it, I don't fucking care, to be honest. I don't give a shit if my wingman was made in 48 country or states. I don't like, does it function? Does it do what it's supposed to do? Like what from your perspective, cause you were in during the fielding of this thing, right? Like what went so wrong with the F-35? Why was it? I mean, because nobody I know likes this thing. We wasted fucking tons of money, like what, $4 billion or some shit on this project? Maybe more than that.
It's insane. Like if you look at like the total cost of the program, they're looking at, they're saying it's a $1 trillion program, which is like hard to even wrap your mind around. And you know, that's for all the countries that it's going to and whatnot. But you know, that makes the dollars and cents of it are really powerful, you know, like it becomes a force in and of itself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the F-35 is like, it's just so, I mean, there's the amount of code that goes into this thing. It's got every bell and whistle you can imagine. I'm sure it's like, it's highly capable at like certain mission sets. Like I know, you know, I'm obviously not read into the F-35 program, so I don't know everything about it, but, you know, I know just talking to the bros that have gone over there that it is very capable, especially for like that seed mission. Mm-hmm. So suppression of enemy air defense and mm-hmm. things like that. It's going to like, it definitely is going to be a game changer in certain arenas. But when you try to take like one platform and replace everything with it, it ends up being not that great at everything, you know? So it's like they had to make it fit the Air Force requirements, the Navy requirements, the Marine requirements, you know, it's mission capable rates, the cost per flight hour. There's so many things that are gonna, that just point to me that it's like, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. Sure. So,
yeah, and like you said, if you're trying to do everything, you're not going to be great at anything, right? It's like the Cheesecake Factory menu, right? It's too many fucking pages, man.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even the pilots in the training, you only have so much bandwidth, and so it's like you can't be excellent at everything. You can either be a jack of all trades, or you can be an expert in one or two or maybe three mission sets. And so, you know, another big thing you're going to lose when you retire the A-10 is the A-10 squadrons, which are kind of like, they're the torch for everything close air support. So that's where, you know, the kind of that knowledge base lives. And when that goes away, you're never going to get it back.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Turn holiday travel from stressful to rewarding. Rakuten helps you save big on travel. They give you cash back when you book with sites like Expedia, Best Western, and Hertz. Even better, you can stack cash back on top of other rewards like airline miles, credit card points, and hotel loyalty programs. Rakuten partners with over 3,700 stores, including Away Luggage, Ray-Ban, and Macy's, so you can be prepared with all the travel essentials and, of course, cute fits for your trip. Keep the rewards going with cash back on holiday gifts for friends and family. With Rakuten, you'll never miss out on savings at your favorite stores. The stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Join for free and start your shopping at Rakuten.com or use the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.
What do you know about the what I guess we're calling these aircraft, next generation air dominance, the NGAD or whatever the fuck they're calling it? So essentially, it's a stealth fighter, but it has AI that does a lot of stuff on it, targeting systems. I mean, it does real-time geospatial intelligence is really what it does, right? So it's kind of ISR mixed with it's AI ISR that's mixed with a fighter that has an actual pilot in it, right? That's the sixth-gen fighter that we're working on right now. And it's fucking incredible, right? Like, it has a version, like, I've looked into some of the publicly available specs. It has I don't even know what you would call it, but it's a blue force tracker on fucking all the steroids, right? Like it can not only it's using geometric analysis to tell, like it can pick out certain types of aircraft that are in the area. It can just like facial recognition, basically look at the ground targets and find anti-air. It can find tacticals and tanks on the ground and fucking map them out in milliseconds, right? Like within less than a second, it can do all this stuff. And then it can project that data to the entire battle space all at the same time, right? In real time. We've never had anything even close. Like I'm not even sure I've seen something like this in science fiction before, to be honest. I mean, it's incredible what this thing can do. And if that's what we know it can do, you know, there's like so much other bullshit that's going on there. I mean, we're talking about some stuff that has been theorized in AI targeting systems is, you know, we're looking for a very specific target somewhere. Let's say it's 2011. We're looking for bin Laden and we know he's in that house, right? He walks outside and looks up in the sky and our fucking facial recognition from that stealth fighter hits him and it sends a bomb right down his throat. Right. Like that's a thing. That's a real possibility now.
Oh yeah. I like you, I don't have any, inside information on NGAD, but it absolutely looks wicked. And, you know, I mean, you look at what the, F-22 brings to the fight, and then you look at that's going to replace the Raptor. And yeah, it just kind of is mind blowing. I never thought I would see the day when the F-22 was retired, but it looks like that might actually happen.
And all the ones they like when you put all these into service, all the ones that are in a particular battle space will be essentially AI networked, right? So they're all it's like let's just say there's a squadron, there's 7 to 10 of these assholes flying around a certain area, and it's mapping like full on geospatial, right? Like from everything from the topography to weather to the enemy troops in the area to friendly troops in the area all at the same time. I mean, it's fucking wild as hell. This is like a form of battle that I don't think we've ever seen before, frankly. It's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out, to be honest, because nobody, I don't think anybody else has this particular thing yet. We're usually, when it comes to air, we're usually 15, 20 years ahead of everybody else typically. So this is kind of like a game changer. I don't know how much you know about AI, but are you worried at all about networking stealth fighters with AI? You know what I mean? That seems like it could go wrong at some point.
Yeah, it's like definitely makes you think of some like sci-fi.
Yeah, like Battlestar Galactica or some shit.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, I mean, I watched the networked battle space go from like an idea to a reality just over my career.
From little dots on a green screen, right? That sucked and they weren't really that accurate. Yeah. Like the original Blue Force Tracker was a piece of shit.
Oh yeah. Garbage. And I remember thinking like these nerds like are just wasting money and time. So maybe I'm like a Luddite, but you know, my first deployment in the Hog in 06, I mean, we're still carrying like huge stacks of 1 to 50 maps of the whole country. And so, you know, you get rolled to a tick and you pull out your kind of like master map key and you plot your troops in contact and you're like, okay, that's on this map that's labeled Alpha 6 or whatever it is. And then you go flip through your map bag and you pull out your 1 to 50. And then of course, like the battle space is like right in between like three maps. So you're like trying to sort it all out when you're en route. And then, you know, by the end of my career, it was like no one was carrying those maps anymore because it was all digital. Mm-hmm. You have like, you know, there was obviously potential for errors and mistakes in the data link, but it definitely enhanced your combat capabilities, you know, when you're just plot the targets, the threats, the friendlies, and it just shows up on your moving map display in your jet. And then you have the HMIC system, which goes over your eye, so you can actually see like a three-dimensional representation of the digital battle space overlaid onto the actual battle space. So you're like, oh, you know, you roll into say like a troops in contact and you just start seeing all the friendlies lined up outside, and then you see anything else that has been input into the battle space and you're like, wow, they actually pulled this off. So yeah, I can only imagine what the next generation of that will be when they're implementing AI and all the unmanned systems in there. It's going to be insane.
Yeah, I mean, especially if the same AI platform with their threat library is, let's just say they're drones, they're not even fighters, right? They're just moving around as fast as they can to avoid detection or whatever, right? To avoid getting shot down. But they're providing a real-time, like, detailed image of the battle space at this point, right? Like, AI can, I'm sure you've seen the pictures, the high-def pictures you've seen of outer space, they're probably like somewhere between 3,000 and 30,000 individual pictures that have been put together, right? And but now this AI can do it in real time, like literally in real time. So a drone with a couple of cameras on it is taking 1,000 pictures a minute, basically. And then there's 7 of those, and they're putting all those pictures together, and you have like it's like a fucking video game. And latency has always been an issue in a kinetic fight, right? This stuff reduces latency essentially to how quickly the weapons officer can react with their thumb. You know what I mean? I mean, that is, obviously there's going to be some tests that need to be done on the targeting systems and stuff because, from what I hear right now, the AI can already tell, this is just geometry, so I don't think this is very difficult, but it can tell from standoff distance, the difference between one of our aircraft and like a J-20 Chinese aircraft or an Su-35 or what type of drone something is. It's only a matter of time before, you know, somebody finds a way to fuck with that somehow, adding an extra panel onto something or something like that, or, you know, who knows. So it's going to be a work in progress, but this is pretty interesting stuff. Do you feel like you got out at the wrong time?
No, man, I was ready to go.
Well, after 20, but, you did 24 years, right?
22. Yeah. Mm. But, something I think there's a lot of promising technology with this stuff, but something that I'm concerned about too is, as we become more reliant on this tech, like, are we losing kind of those like foundational warfighting skills that might actually still be reliant because we might need to be reliant upon because of kind of some of the limitations of the new way of warfighting? It's like, well, what if these systems fail? What if they get jammed? What if we don't have the manufacturing base to produce the smart weapons that match, you know, that these systems are going to put on target? And then it's like, okay, well now, well, we can turn, you know, the Ford factory into this, it's one of those things where it's like, these capabilities are awesome. We should be pushing the envelope. But, my concern with it is that we, we don't put all our eggs in the technology basket and then have an entire generation of fighter pilots that don't actually know how to like Viz ID aircraft, read a map, navigate without GPS. Like, you know, because the enemy always gets a vote. And it's like, are they just going to stand by while we just dominate? Or is there going to be these competitions, you know, where we have an evolution and then they have a counter to it. So anyhow, just something else that comes to mind when I think of all these advanced technologies.
Yeah, well, that's what happened with the agency. I mean, we became dependent on signal intelligence and lost the human intelligence capabilities that made them, you know, good at their job. Now they're not so good at it. But yeah, if you read the 9/11 commission report, the two major points that they make that are to blame for 9/11 being a successful operation. One is the lack of human, right? Like just depending too much on technology. And the other one was not sharing information between intelligence agencies. It's like those two main points that kind of fucked us over. And when you're dealing, like we're rich, we can do whatever the fuck we want, but we're fighting people who are, you know, going to take out a multi-million dollar aircraft with a $35,000 piece of equipment, or in some cases they're taking out multi-million dollar tanks with $50 worth of something, right? So like, it's not all about who's got the best technology always. So those capabilities really matter.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You need that, like those foundational skills. And I even saw it like as a hog dude throughout my career. I mean, Near the end of my career, I was the director of ops for A-10 training, and we were in charge of the syllabus for the initial qualification. And you start having all these new requirements for learning. You know, the students need to learn how to just say, drop GBU-54s, which is like a, you know, GPS laser guided bomb. They need to be able to drop small diameter bombs. They need to, you know, they start adding all of these requirements, and you don't have more time to train them. So we'd constantly have to kind of look at the syllabus and say, all right, what are we going to take out to add these things? And as you do that, you know, you're like, again, you're just losing some of those foundational skills in favor of the technology. So it's like, okay, this is all well and good, but if you have a hog driver that can't, again, navigate with a map, with no GPS, find a target with his eyeballs and shoot it with the gun, like at what point are you just gonna be a really slow, ineffective you know, F-35 at right, that point? So yeah, so again, yeah, it's just it's really an interesting thing, which yeah. Goes back to our earlier conversation, which is why I'm kind of an advocate of that single role and then multiple platforms. So you have that leading technological edge, but then you have other tools in the toolkit should the need arise.
Yeah, it's funny how we tried to become singular dimension wise with some of our aircraft at the same time that we were redesigning infantry units into BCTs, right? To have a CAV element, to have an SCT element, and all this other stuff. So like while the Army was getting more resilient, I guess, and diverse in the way they handle their problems, the Air Force and Navy seem to get pigeonholed for some reason. And it's probably a money issue. Who fucking knows? At any rate, so at some point, you get promoted out of the cockpit, right? I mean, that's just kind of the sad reality of being a pilot, unfortunately, in the military. At some point, unless you're Tom Cruise, obviously, at some point you got to fucking hang up the leather jacket and go sit in a fucking office somewhere. What was that like? That transition must have sucked.
Oh, yeah. You know, I remember when I was going through pilot training, you had to sign a 10-year commitment. And I remember thinking, like, I would sign a 20-year commitment. I would sign a 30-year commitment. I would sign the rest of my life commitment. I did not care. I was like, I get paid to do this. My, you know, this is incredible. But then, you know, kind of you see how reality unfolds. And then as you progress in your career, the Air Force sees you as an officer first. So meaning you have to develop, you know, leadership. They want you to learn how to operate on a staff. They want you to get educated at these higher levels. So yeah, it's like the first 10 years is just everything you dreamed of. And then all of a sudden you're like just being tortured, staring at, you know, screens and living in a cubicle, right. Working on PowerPoint slides, yeah, responding to emails. And you're like, this is basically like working for freaking Target or something. This is hell on earth.
That's why I enlisted instead of going the officer route for that reason, especially in the infantry. It's like, unless you go into SOF, maybe you get to fight a little bit as a second lieutenant, and then maybe you get to fight a little bit as a captain, and that's it, right? You're done fighting. It's like that. Well, I'm not gonna go through all this shit to get in once. You know what I mean? Fuck that. That's crazy. But so you retired after 22 years, and what was that transition like for you? You went back to Oregon, right? Pretty much, and you started doing your own thing, or how did that go?
Yeah, so I'm still kind of going through it, you know, still figuring things out, but kind of the normal pass if you're a pilot and an officer is like go to airlines or maybe go to corporate America and be a consultant or whatever, you know, really whatever it may be. The Air Force sent me to get an MBA at one point, or paid for my MBA, which was cool, but you know, so I'm looking at all those kind of normal paths, and I'm starting to feel that pressure of like, man, I don't want to do any of this stuff. Like, you know, an airline pilot is a great career. I mean, they, you know, they work maybe like 5-10 days at a time and then have equal or more time off. And then as you increase in seniority, the pay is really good and the off time is great. But, I just, for me personally, in my, you know, now I'm in my mid 40s, I've got young kids, I'm like, I don't want to miss another birthday, another Christmas, another soccer practice, whatever it may be. So I didn't really want to do that. And then I started looking at the corporate side, and that sounded like equally miserable. You know, I'm sure, again, not to like diminish what anybody does, I'm sure people have rewarding great careers out of all these different paths, but it just, I didn't feel inspired or called to do any of that. So, you know, my wife and I are just kind of started like reverse engineer the lifestyle we're hoping to live. So we started just basically writing out kind of some of our, you know, what are our values, what are our desires, our principles. And, you know, we wanted to just live a clean, healthy lifestyle. Want to homeschool our girls, be close to family and parents and stuff. And so we just decided to come back home, and we ended up buying like 50 acres of, it's basically like half pasture land, half timber land, and started a small like cow-calf operation. So yeah, I went from being a, you know, military guy for most of my adult life to, it's kind of non-standard, but like basically running cows and selling timber for my property. And that's basically what I do now. In addition to, again, doing like I do my girls' like math homeschool curriculum, and my wife does everything else. But yeah, so it's just like, I don't know. It's like this modern, like Little House on the Prairie type situation now.
Are you teaching them geometry using like a flight simulator or something? Because that would be the best way to learn it, to be honest. That would be the coolest way to learn geometry.
Yeah. I mean, it's so cool doing, I love teaching them. It's just it's so rewarding, and you're bonding, and I try to make it as fun as possible. So yeah, when you're doing geometry, we'll be like, if we even start out, we're learning like how to read a compass and headings and stuff and degrees and things like that. I'm like, okay, let's get our compass and we're going to be airplanes and we're going to fly around. Okay. And I'll be like, fly, you know, heading 090. And they'll get their little compass and walk that way. And they're like, okay, I'm going 090. Now, if you turn 90 degrees right, what heading are you? And, you know, I'll give them like air traffic control clearance. And yeah, it's just, it's awesome, man. Like, you know, I've talked about this before, but it just hit me. I'm like, okay, my girls are now, they're 7 and 10. And, I'm, you know, when you're in the Air Force, you're an officer, if you're in any kind of high pressure career, it's not uncommon to work, you know, 60, 70 hours a week. You know, we might even be like having to get ready for your Monday morning mission on Sunday. Mm-hmm. So it's just for me anyway. I know everyone has kind of a different bandwidth, but it took like just everything to be kind of like an average A-10 dude. It took like just my entire force of will to be moderately successful on this path. And then, you know, I'm looking at it going, if I keep pushing this hard and my kids are being educated at public schools or whatever it may be, it's like, okay, they're going to be gone out of the house. And are they going to have our values? Or are they going to have someone else's values? And I don't know. We just started kind of thinking about it. Like, again, what are our priorities? And then we really then work backwards from there. And so, yeah, it's I don't know exactly where I'm going with that, other mm-hmm. than it's kind of a non-standard situation, but it's really rewarding. And it's just a lot of fun too.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people fantasize about that, about, being able to be a little bit more self-sufficient, because what comes with that is less people being able to fuck with you, right? Especially the government. What do you feel like you're sacrificing though for all this stuff? Because certainly at least some convenience, and there's a lot of hard work involved and shit, but that's not for somebody that spent 20 years, you know, in a high stress environment like that. Probably it doesn't seem as bad relatively, right? But it is still different than living in a fucking townhouse downtown and having your everything managed by somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, the way I looked at it was really it's costing me is probably making more money. But I'm looking at it going, like, okay, what point is having enough? And, you know, I probably won't do this exactly like I'm doing it now forever. But yeah, so yeah, it's costing me, you know, I'm not getting a big salary from a Fortune 500 company or from FedEx or Delta or whatever it is. But it's like, you know, kind of thinking, what is all this consumerism gotten us? Has it improved our families? You know, has it improved our lives? And so I look at it as kind of like a return to what's important. And then, you know, you look at what the government did during COVID, and they're just like, you know, shut everyone in their houses, you know, pretty much made the vaccine mandatory, even if you felt like you didn't need it because you already had COVID or you're healthy or whatever it may be, you know, and you're just going like, there was even talk of like, oh, well, you know, if you haven't got the vaccine, you shouldn't be allowed to go into a grocery store. And you realize that it's like, we're heavily reliant on this system that's now being run by people who probably despise me and my values and what I think's important. And so if I can be a little bit less reliant on them and a little bit more self-reliant, and then that's probably a good thing. And do I think that we're going to have some sort of like, you know, collapse tomorrow? I don't. I mean, anything's possible, but I don't live that way. I don't live in fear. But you know, it really, the things you gain from it, again, if you have young kids especially, is you teach them like all the inputs that are required to sustain life. So, you know, for example, not long ago, we had a tree branch fall down in a little storm, and it broke a line for our water system. So it's not, you know, water's not just something magically that shows up to your house. Like, and if something goes wrong, you live in town, you maybe call the city or something, you know, if it's off your property line. But here it's like, okay, let's girls come with me. We go out to the spring. We see the little, you know, there's a mountain water spring near our house. It comes down. We have a capture system and a little spring box. And you see the intake, the line goes and feeds the tank that's then pumped up to our house. And they just see that with their own eyes. And it's like, okay, see, this line got broke and I'm going to repair that. And then we're going to have water again. Mm. And it's just like, I feel like they're just getting a grounded view. You know, they're learning responsibility to a degree that's really hard to emulate, again, if you live in a condo in a city or something. I mean, you know, they've lost, like, they're not pets, they're farm animals, but, you know, they lost chickens and ducks, and they get sad, and you know, they learn how to process that loss. You know, they learn that if they don't get up and give the chickens water, then the chickens aren't going to live. You have to take care of them. You know, they collect the eggs, and then we come inside and make breakfast. So, you know, I just feel like there's a lot of really good lessons that pretty much every human all throughout history learned up until, like, the, you know, very recently we've forgotten a lot of this stuff. So again, it's just kind of I look at it as an opportunity to kind of turn back the clock, focus on what's important to us, and then kind of pass those values to our kids, and those real-time lessons of having to take care of animals, and, you know, again, make sure your own water system's up and running and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people again, would like to do that, but they don't necessarily know when to start or how or what to do, right? You know, I mean, when you decided to go do that, now you grew up in that area, so maybe you had a lot of this information already, but where did you just figure it out? Did you wing it and figure it out, or were there resources you used to kind of, like, well, I mean, you need food and water and shelter first. That's obvious, right? So just use Maslow's hierarchy of needs, at least for the first part. But yeah, like, technical skills, how to repair water lines, how to make sure you have electricity and shit like that. It's sometimes pretty far out of the purview of the ordinary person, right? So, what were the resources you went to figure all this shit out?
Yeah. So, you know, growing up here, I worked on a dairy farm when I was a kid, and, I still know the guy who was born and raised on that dairy farm and then ran it for 50 years. And now he runs beef cows, and he's in his, like, late 70s. And so when it comes to the cow-calf operation, he's kind of my mentor on that. So so really just using the local resources I've got, you know, we, like, did a ton of research, probably read, I don't know, probably, I want to say two, maybe 50 books on the topic of anything from raising grass-fed beef to gardening to everything. You know, it's kind of the last 5 years of my career is where thinking about making this step, we're just getting really excited about it and devouring information. And there's so many resources available online now too. Like, you can pretty much, like, YouTube anything, and you can find an expert who has, like, a GoPro camera on his hat and will be doing any required task on a ranch and just talking through what he's doing. So watched a ton of YouTube from experts as well. And then just kind of just learning real time. I mean, like, I feel like I've gained, like, so much knowledge just in, like, the last year. And I can't imagine what it's going to be like in 5 years from now, because there's an infinite amount to learn. And really, if you want to do it, you just got to get started. And really what mistakes cost you is money. So good ranchers and bad ranchers, the only thing that differentiates them is how much money they're spending. Like, so a bad rancher just goes out of business because they waste money at every front because they don't know what they're doing, you know? So, yeah, so you got to be wise about it. You got to be shrewd, but really you just have to get started. And I would say the best thing you can do is start small and learn at a small scale, and then scale up from there.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a number of online resources for sure. Like, we recently had a guest, Jack Spierko. He's from the Survival Podcast, thesurvivalpodcast.com. All kinds of information.
I listened to that episode. That guy's on another level.
Yeah, he's smart. He's got it figured out for sure. He's got a YouTube channel as well, but you can actually sign up for classes on his website. And then there's a couple other books that I use. One's called The Self-Sufficient Backyard, and it's a nice primer on how to do those kind of small projects. And then there's some bigger ones, like No Grit Survival Projects is another one that's really good.
and it's like how to build water trapping and everything from there to like building shelters or whatever, preserving food long term, whatever you want to do. Now, a lot of this stuff is kind of survivalist base, so maybe it isn't, maybe you don't think that you need, like, I'm not a prepper. I'm not worried about, like you said, I'm not terribly worried about everything collapsing necessarily. But, you know, those are people who are very in touch with how to do this stuff with very minimal resources, right? So that's the person you want to learn from. You know, when we learn navigation, they don't hand you a GPS. They hand you a compass and a map, the most rudimentary way you can do it, right? Then you learn more advanced skills later. But, yeah, I would start small with some of that stuff as well. There's a million different books out there as far as sourcing food. Anything that Steve Rinella writes is pretty good. So, yeah, there's a lot of information out there if you guys are looking to start that. And it's a good idea if you're in an urban area now and you're thinking about moving out of an urban area, take on some of these small projects first and kind of get a feel for it, right? So when you get out there, you're not completely retarded, I guess.
If you don't like physical labor, like, you're not going to have a good time. So just, you know, if you're going to run a one man operation, it's going to be hard work. Like, there's no easy way to build fence. Even if you have an auger, you know, and a machine and all this stuff, it's still hard work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you have to enjoy the hard work outside and problem solving. And something I found too is, it's actually kind of sad, but there's so many ranchers who are the last generation ranchers right now. And their kids all went off to college and got jobs doing different things. And they're basically, it's going to end with them. And they are really excited and hungry to pass on their information because they have a lifetime of knowledge of doing all this stuff. And when they see someone that's relatively young and motivated, I've got a ton of people that want to help and can give me advice on things because they're makes them feel good that somebody younger is picking up the torch.
Yeah, that's great. And it's, this is institutional knowledge, right? Like, if shit does go sideways, we better have enough people that know how to do this stuff. Otherwise we're fucked because the average urbanite isn't heading out to the woods and figuring it out, right? Like, you're going to eat the wrong thing or you're going to not find clean water and you're going to be dead in 2 weeks, to be honest. Like, don't kid yourself and think you're ready for it now. All right, we got to get out of here. Thanks for coming today. Tell everybody where they can find you so they can follow your stuff on the internet. I know you got a pretty big Twitter.
Yeah, mainly on Twitter. You can just follow me at DaleStark810, where I've got the that's where I post most of everything that's going on. Like, what I'm doing out here is kind of like building the plane as you fly it, if you will. So doing a lot of work outside and on the infrastructure of this place, getting it where I need it to be. And once I get a lot of that done, then I will, again, be able to expand from there and maybe at some point eventually be able to ship product. But up to this point, I'm just selling locally here in Southern Oregon. So, yeah, if you're interested, just follow me. I read my DMs maybe once a month or something. So if you send me a note, I may or may not get it. But that's the best place to follow along, and I'll put on any updates up there.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming today. It's been a great conversation. A lot of fun information. I like the Warthog. I think any infantry person probably has some kind of relationship with that particular aircraft. And yeah, the lifestyle stuff is also super interesting. So thanks for coming today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the invite. It's great to meet you finally. I've been listening to your show for a while now, so it's cool to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you, sir. And thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen. Boom. Yeah, that was great.
Oh, sorry, man.
Recording my dogs stopped.
We're kind of, I was trying to get my dogs away, and then I'm also,
it's all right.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.